United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe. Welcome to the Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain with Seminary Ridge Review. My guest is David LaMotte, award-winning songwriter, author, and peace activist based in Black Mountain, North Carolina. He's been performing for over 25 years, and he's been part of many artist compilations. His music has been heard on The Today Show and This American Life. David, welcome to the Seminary Explorers.
Such a pleasure to be with you, Katie.
Because it's the five-year anniversary of White Flower, I'd like to start there. I'd like to ask you about the project and the events that led up to it.
It's been a big piece of my life in these last 5 years or so. What happened, this is a children's book that I wrote that's based on a poem that I wrote that's based on true events that happened 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. We actually published the book about these events on the five-year anniversary of the event itself. Mm-hmm. So as we celebrated the five-year anniversary of the publishing of the book, we also celebrated the 10-year anniversary of the event itself, which in a nutshell is a Klan rally in Knoxville, Tennessee, May 26, 2007, that was facetiously joined by a clown rally. The clowns showed up in full regalia, having carefully rehearsed a bunch of street theater, having brought their props, joined in with the Klan, so that when the Klan started chanting white, and I should say I'm using the term Klan historically, it was broader than that. It was mostly a neo-Nazi group. There were some Klansmen there as well. But it's in the book, I depict them as Klansmen because that's shorthand for active racism. So at any rate, at this rally, the Klan started chanting white power, and the clowns sort of put their hands to their ears and listened and acted like they couldn't understand what the Klan was saying. And then they said, oh, I've got it. I figured this out. And this is awesome. This is a rally for white flour. And they pulled out bags of flour and had a big flour fight in the street. And people were laughing. And the energy that the Klan was trying to create was subverted by this creative comic action. So they worked that gag for a few minutes, and then a few minutes later they said, no, you know, I think maybe we heard them wrong. I don't think they were saying white flower. I think they were saying white flowers. And they start handing out flowers to everybody in the crowd. When somebody hands you a small white flower, it's hard to be caught up in the hatred, right? And so they did that for a few minutes, and then they said, nope, that wasn't it. It was actually tight showers, and they held up a camp shower, and they're all crowding beneath it and having a big time, making people laugh. And then finally, their pièce de résistance was, they said, no, that's not what this is. This is a rally for wife power. And they all pulled on wedding dresses and started chanting wife power. Yeah. There were others that didn't make it in the book that they actually did that day, but they did all those things, right? I didn't make this up. I just made it rhyme. So these activists, who were mostly from a group called Mountain Justice, got together. They're environmental activists most of the time, but they decided they needed to respond to this when this rally was announced for Knoxville. And they did in such brilliant form. And what I love about it is that it's such an incredible example of Walter Wenck's third way. You know, when Wenck wrote about creative conflict transformation, I think this is what he was getting at, you know. And part of what I think is powerful about it is that they did subvert the work that the Klan was trying to do actively and effectively, very effectively. And they refused to become that which they abhor. Right, they didn't meet hatred with hatred. They didn't meet violence with violence. They didn't meet fear with fear. They took this energy and they transformed it. The Klan had the town square reserved for 4 hours, and they left 90 minutes early. They had no idea what to do with this. They're used to being feared. They're used to being hated. But they didn't know how to deal with humor and laughter. And it wasn't At no point did the clowns insult the Klansmen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They didn't say, you know, your mom addresses you funny. They said they refused to take the ideas that the Klansmen were presenting seriously. And that's an important, a subtle distinction, but a very important distinction. So I think it's just a brilliant entry into a conversation about nonviolence, which always requires creativity, because our natural responses are obviously fight and flight. You know, that's deep in us.
Right.
And to move beyond those natural responses to something that's deeper and more profound and more effective, we have to be creative. The obvious things are right in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
The best things require creative thought.
And also it's not reactive, it's proactive, right?
Yeah.
Because our instinctual reaction is, I mean, even when we're right to say you're wrong, I mean, that isn't effective.
Yeah.
And that is just, that's sort of the like animal reaction, or that's just the knee-jerk reaction, and that's not gonna be helpful, even if you're justified.
Precisely.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's a pretty sound argument to be made that violence in general goes that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not terribly effective in addressing a problem.
Yeah.
It tends to lead to more violence.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the world is complicated, and I don't mean to. That's not from a statement of moral judgment. I get to make decisions for myself about how I respond to things. And though I'm committed to the idea of nonviolence and trying to live toward that, I don't claim to be nonviolent, even myself. So I certainly have no critique of anyone else in the choices that they make in very difficult situations. But I think we will all be doing better if we can learn more creative responses. Peacemakers talk a lot, nonviolent folks that I've studied talk a lot about interrupting the script. You know, we have a clear script. You know, somebody punches you, you punch them back. That's what the script says. But when you break into song and dance, everybody is shocked. And being shocked gives us a moment to reconsider whether this is how we want to approach this moment or not. I did this accidentally one time. I get no credit for it. It just happened. But I was at a big folk festival in Texas. It was hot and dusty. People were tired from sleep deprivation, staying up all night playing music and listening to it. And two adult men who I know and respect both of them had been getting on each other's nerves for days.
Mm-hmm.
And I came around the corner having walked away to do something, and I found these two guys about to come to blows, you know, with their chest puffed out and just yelling at each other and all. And it was such a ridiculous scene to me that I wasn't sure at first whether they were kidding or not. So I decided to assume that they were. And I stepped into this and poked my own chest out. And people listening to audio don't know, but I'm not a physically imposing guy by any long stretch of the imagination. And so I poked my own chest out and got up in their faces and said, "Hey, you want some of this? Huh? Come on, guys. You want to go? You want to go? Because you don't want to tangle with this, right?" And I'm holding up my skinny, skinny arms and pointing to my muscles and or lack thereof. And they both, you know, kind of huffed in disgust, but they stepped back.
Uh-huh.
And that's what it took in the moment. A little bit of humor just interrupted the script.
Sticks a pin in it, right?
Yeah.
Takes out
it
the
just
air,
deflates
takes
it.
Out the hotter.
Right. Right.
Wow, excellent. You talk about powerlessness in a lot of ways. This is one of the things that you speak about a lot, right? Is there something that you'd like to say about that? Also, I mean, we're sort of getting to it with the surprise or the effectiveness of it, but why is this something that's so just desperately important right now, talking about powerlessness?
Well, a lot of people are fearful right now on all sides of the political divide that is consuming so much of our energy and attention in the States and really a lot of places around the world. And I think it's important that we be intentional about the choices we're making and how we orient ourselves in the world. And it is easy to be overwhelmed. You know, the news is extraordinary every single day. It's mind-blowing. And the problems are huge. And we often feel pretty small in the face of those problems. And so we feel powerless. I don't think we are powerless. And I think part of this sense of that comes from getting the narrative of change wrong. Hmm. Getting the narrative, having a misunderstanding of how it is that we make large-scale change when you've got a large-scale problem on a societal level. Because we have a deeply embedded narrative of change as a culture, I believe, that I call the hero narrative. Mm-hmm. This is not an original idea to mm-hmm. me, but it's one I've been giving a lot of time to in recent years. And the hero narrative says if you got a big problem, what you need is somebody extraordinary mm-hmm. to do something dramatic in a moment of crisis. Mm-hmm. And that's how you fix the problem. If folks are not convinced that this is our dominant narrative of change, I encourage them to go to the nearest movie marquee and count how many of the movies there hold this plot. And not just our action movies. I'm talking about our dramas. I'm talking about our children's movies, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That the story we tell our kids, mm-hmm. implicitly and explicitly sometimes, is there may come a moment in your life when you are called upon to summon all your strength and courage and skill and do something bold and brave and do the right thing and be the hero. The problem with that narrative is, okay, so you've got a big problem. What's your job? Step one, wait. Wait for that moment, uh-huh. right? And when that moment comes, I don't know about you, Katie, but I don't wake up feeling particularly heroic most mornings, right? So mostly we're told to wait for the hero.
Yeah.
And in an effort to tell inspiring stories, we often blow our heroes up so big, we dehumanize them to the degree that we can't relate to them.
Yeah.
So we don't imagine ourselves in these roles, and we don't measure our actions against the actions of folks we admire.
Yeah.
We see our role as to clap.
Mm-hmm.
Heroes fix stuff. The rest of us clap. That's what we do. We celebrate them, right?
Yeah.
And we hope that in the moment that we're called upon, we rise to the challenge for this big dramatic action. But the thing is, most of us never encounter that moment,
yeah.
right? And it's a defeating narrative all the way along because it tells you that your role is to wait.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of us do a lot of days. We see a big problem and we wait. The competing narrative is the movement narrative. And the movement narrative says that if you've got a big problem and you need to address it, what you need is a lot of people to make motion in the same direction, to do small things. The movement narrative says that if you want to make a change, you need a lot of people to do a little bit each.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when things change. Now, historically, we reduce history to the hero narrative. But it never, ever happens that way, in my experience, right? It's not how large-scale change happens. The role of heroes is not to address the problem. The role of heroes is to inspire the rest of us to address the problem. And when the rest of us get involved, that's when the problem gets fixed. Now, I'm talking about large-scale social change issues. And I'm not saying for a moment that people don't do heroic, extraordinarily brave things. They do. But the narrative is problematic in terms of how we deal with a large problem. And it's self-defeating. So that sense of powerlessness that a lot of us feel a lot of the time is ill-founded because we don't understand how change gets made. Change gets made by a lot of people doing a little bit each. I do a lot of work around the Rosa Parks story mm-hmm. and our mistelling of it mm-hmm. because we tell that story in such a way that it really is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
The deeper you get into the story, the more respect you have for Rosa Parks. That's the good news, not mm-hmm. not less.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a movement person. We don't tell the story when we tell kids about Rosa Parks' arrest, her first arrest, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We also don't tell the story of her second arrest. But we don't tell, when we're talking about that story, about the fact that she was the secretary for the Montgomery NAACP for 12 years mm-hmm. before she was arrested. That 3 months before she was arrested, she traveled to the Highlander Center to study voter registration and nonviolence. And then 3 months later, what a coincidence,
mm-hmm.
there she was getting arrested on the bus, we don't tell the details also of how that system worked. And the fact that, in fact, the central fact of that story is a lie. Rosa Parks was not arrested for not giving up her seat so that a white man could sit down in it. That is not true. The way the system worked was that there was a little sign that moved back that said whites only. And so when the bus was full, it moved back a row. So four people had to stand with three empty seats so that that white man could sit down. Rosa Parks was sitting on the left side of the bus on the aisle. And when he came to board the bus, all four of the people sitting there looked forward for just a moment and did not move. The bus driver said, "I need those seats. Mm-hmm. Y'all better make it easy on yourselves." According to Rosa Parks' autobiography, he said, "Y'all better make it easy on yourselves." And three of them got up and moved to the back. Rosa Parks moved from the aisle over to the window to give the man plenty of room on the other side of the bus. So she was arrested for not giving up her seat so that it could sit empty with two other empty seats and an aisle between her and that man. Mm-hmm. That's what she was arrested for. Right. But February 22nd, 1956, less than 3 months after that arrest, she was arrested again when they came to arrest everybody who had organized all the transportation needs for the boycott, because it went on for over a year and people still had mm-hmm. to get to work, right? Mm-hmm. The day they came to arrest 89 people who for operating this illegal transportation company, they said, and also for having a boycott without a just cause, which was an old Alabama law on the books that hadn't been enforced in years and wasn't accurately enforced that day, of course. She got arrested again, and that day, you know what she was doing? She was answering the phones. She was a dispatcher, just getting people around town. She went right back to the mundane, everyday movement work because she understood what we don't, that that's the part that matters, just moving it forward. And nobody's ever heard of Joanne Robinson, who actually called the Montgomery bus boycott, not Dr. King, not mm-hmm. Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. Joanne Robinson, who is the head of the Women's Political Council, they had had the boycott organized for a year in advance. So it was the movement that won that battle, right? And Rosa Parks played a really important part and a mm-hmm. courageous, wonderful part. But she didn't do that, right? She inspired a lot of other people to get arrested and to join the movement. A lot of people came down from up north explicitly to join the movement because they were inspired by her. So her job was not to fix the problem. Her job was to inspire the rest of us to get off our butts and get mm-hmm. in the game.
It's a tip of the iceberg thing. And it does happen over and over. It's mm-hmm. not just the way things happen, but the way we present them as having happened.
That's exactly.
That's an excellent example.
Stories matter. Stories matter. And it's fascinating. Dorothy Day, who's mm-hmm. one of the founders of the Catholic mm-hmm. Worker Movement, came to be interviewed one day by a young reporter who said, "Sister Day, I'm really honored to have this time with you. I've never interviewed a saint before." And her answer was, "Don't call me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed that easily."
Ooh, yeah.
Isn't that mm-hmm. it, right? Mm-hmm. If there's saints and the rest of us, mm-hmm. then it's the saints' job to fix things, and our job is to clap, to praise and to worship, and to stop there.
Yeah.
And I think this all maps really interestingly theologically as well, because you can look at the Jesus story mm-hmm. as a hero narrative or a movement narrative, and people look at it both ways.
Yes.
A lot of Christian theology is kind of rooted in the idea that Jesus did this awesome thing for me, saved me, and my job is to praise and worship, and that's where it stands. And that's the hero narrative of Jesus. The movement narrative of Jesus is Jesus is inviting me to change the world, mm-hmm. to join his movement, to do what he did, to live differently. And there's responsibility in that, and I need to change. And those are really different narratives, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, this is a tiny, tiny spark on that, but it's the kind of thinking that we are thinking right now at Gettysburg Seminary and at our sister seminary in Philadelphia as we're joining this summer. And we're really excited about it, but it's also, change is always disruptive.
Oh,
I know that it's easy. We've got these groups, so current and future employees and faculty members and alumni, you know, big groups of alumni and current students. It's also easy right now to feel like, well, we're going to wait until the new president comes, and we're going to wait and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. And I think we really all need to, just as you described, be reminded that we each have responsibility, and that we will make it easier on each other if we all embrace this and and move forward. I'm not articulating it very well, but there is a parallel that is absolutely affecting the way that we get up and come to work every day right now. This summer.
Yeah. I do a lot of work in churches, of course, doing workshops and speaking and such. And I sometimes use an example that I think is somewhat parallel of how, you know, sometimes I hear churches say, what we need to do is get a new young pastor, and that young pastor will bring in all these young families, and then the church will be healthy again, and it'll be just like the 50s. It'd be great, right?
Because the 50s were just paradise.
Exactly, because wasn't that awesome for some people? Yes. But that's problematic. You know, it is the church's job to be the church, and the hero is actually not going to save the day. Hopefully the new pastor can hold together the community and challenge and nourish folks in the work of being the church. But it maps this dichotomy of the hero movement and the hero narrative or the movement narrative maps really interesting out on a lot of this dichotomy of the hero narrative versus the movement narrative maps interestingly onto a lot of conversations.
Yeah. And also there's almost a kind of doubling up of that in a place like a seminary, because we are forming future church leaders in the broadest sense, whether it's in parishes or elsewhere. And so in addition to the expectations that they have, they are going out into the world with these expectations placed upon them, you know.
That's
so
right.
there are things in each of their lives that they are sort of waiting for someone to be helpful with, you know, whether it's politically or, you know, however, and yet they are going forward, and they are facing incredible expectations,
yes.
And sometimes really unhealthy, frankly, expectations. And so there's this really there's a real awareness here. How do we not only train but also support and realistically prepare these students to go out into the world now? It's very, very pertinent. In your travels and your training at University of Queensland, I know this is, you know, an enormous topic, but I was just wondering if there's something that you'd like to say about, I mean, that's literally the other side of the world. And when you came back to the States after that experience, is there just one example of something that you'd like to say that really surprised you, or that maybe someone who hasn't traveled that far and that intentionally might not have thought of?
So I actually plotted out what the exact opposite of the world, the other point is, from my home in Black Mountain. And it's off the coast of Australia, actually. It's off the west coast, and I was on the east coast of Australia. But yeah, I've been to Perth, and that's the closest land point to the opposite side of the world from Black Mountain, as you can find. So it's pretty far away. What I did was I did this master's degree at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. And then in between the second and third semesters, I did work in India for 3 months. Some field work with some Gandhian folks there who were doing sustainable development work. It was extraordinary. And I loved it. And it's funny you should ask this question. I just had a conversation within the last week with my sister just a couple of days ago about the fact that Australia is a fiercely egalitarian culture. They are, and I say that with some qualifiers clearly, okay. because there's significant racism and there's, you know, that doesn't apply to all people. But among the mainstream culture, there is a sense of egalitarianism that is much more extreme than in the United States, where we think of ourselves as a fiercely egalitarian culture. Mm-hmm. But, you know, not only political things like having healthcare, you know, socialized healthcare yes. and things mm-hmm. like that. There's solid safety net in Australia that we don't have here. But culturally, things that shocked me in Australia included meeting doctors and dentists who would walk in the room and say, "Hi, I'm Bob. How can I help you?"
Mm.
"Hey, I'm Jen.
Yeah.
How's your day?" Not, "I'm Dr. So-and-so," and mm-hmm. not not even the lab coat a lot mm-hmm. of the time. Walking in street clothes. Wow. That was something different.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went from there to India, which is the precise opposite. India is staggeringly hierarchical.
Oh, great, yes.
And people feel uncomfortable meeting you if they don't know how to treat you. They would prefer to have your resume in advance. And so I guess I was a bit contrarian in playing with that a little bit. But people, I wouldn't tell them my CV, and they wouldn't know how to treat me, and it was very uncomfortable. And in some ways, that's rude. But I also think it's educational. You know, it's good for us to mm-hmm. try to interact as human beings and value each other. So experiencing those two cultures that are both both ends of that spectrum, and then coming back to the States and sort of seeing how that maps mm-hmm. gave me a lens onto my own culture that I wasn't so keenly aware of before.
Yeah, it's that the self-perception, it really is fascinating. It's, I think, when you're either out of the country or even in some cases in the U.S. out of your region, right, depending on the context of like where you grew up or where you live, it can even be going to a different region. It takes that experience to realize things the way that you perceive yourself mm-hmm. and your, you know, community or your country or area of the country. It's not just what you're learning about other people or alternative ways of being and realize that there's not only one kind of normal, but you really do think about yourself in a different way. It's like,
absolutely.
Oh, well, I always just assumed X, Y, and Z, and
absolutely. And the folks at Training for Change do really good work around this and looking at what it means to be mainstream and what it means to be margin, and what are the pros and cons of each, what are the strengths and weaknesses
mm-hmm.
of each.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, one of the strengths of a marginal perspective is that you can see better mm-hmm. from the edge. You know, mm-hmm. the liminal perspective always brings you a clearer picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to get outside of your own culture and become margin
mm-hmm.
To some degree and less mainstream. I deeply value travel. I'm so grateful to have gotten to do a fair amount of that in my life. And what I always really am fascinated by is getting into people's normal. If I can be in people's living rooms, that's so much more interesting to me than being at a monument.
Hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. I am fascinated by, as you said, the many different kinds of normal.
Mm-hmm. Well, are you interested in doing a song, or would you like
yeah,
me to?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I would just love it if you would be willing to.
Yeah. Let me do that. Now the question is, which one? Maybe this. Oh, let me see if I can do this. Something way down.
Sure.
It's because it touches on the Rosa Parks thing. Mm-hmm. If you have another chance at it someday, you may do that. Would you recognize a hero sitting on a city bus? Oh, that no one ever does. Mrs. Parks, you're gonna have to give your seat up. Make it easy on yourself, you know your place. I can call up the police. You can spend the night in jail. She kept her seat and looked him in the face and said, you may do that. Would you recognize a hero sitting on a city bus? Do you think you make a difference? Or that no one really does? You may. Those were her exact words when she was arrested, or actually when the bus driver threatened her with arrest. She said, you may do that. And there's so much power in those four words. This is clearly a person who'd done her homework, right? She knew her nonviolence. She said in those four words, I'm making this decision. It has consequences. Now you have to make a decision. Your decision has consequences. You need to make your decision now, but you don't get to make mine.
Right.
And I was just really struck by all that is said by those four words. So.
And also that it is a decision. Often we feel like when we were talking about powerlessness, as if we don't have a decision,
right.
But there's always some sort of decision.
There is, and there are consequences to different ones, but we always have... Yeah. Choices to make. I should say I co-wrote that song with my friend Wes Collins.
Okay. Thank you. But you've been listening to the Seminary Explores podcast. I'm Katie Giebenhain with Seminary Ridge Review. My guest has been David Lamott. Visit his website at davidlamotte.com. David, thank you so much for your time.
Such a pleasure. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you. You have been listening to The Seminary Explores, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.